I want to assure you that in this extended family of brothers and sisters, some of whom are older and some who are younger, some who are grandparents and some who are just parents and some who are waiting to be parents, that there should always be a sense of togetherness and helpfulness and encouragement and support. And that's what I intend to do tonight. I would like, if I could, to give some sense of confidence to those who are trying with earnestness to rear their children and who are in the very midst of it and sometimes some trying parts of it. And I would like to offer some reproof to those who may have gone to sleep in the midst of it. And even that I intend to be an encouragement, not some sort of destructive criticism. I believe you care. It's possible for people that care to forget for a while. Not because they have no concern, but because other things began to take their interest and their concern. And there are so many things in life that will just reach out and take you and take all the energy that you have that needs to be given to things more important. I have been in recent weeks, along with my wife, sitting down with some young couples who are expecting their first child. And we've been talking about getting ready. I say that not to my credit, but to theirs, because they are the ones who ask for it. They felt the need of some thoughtful, prayerful consideration of what is ahead of them. And I suppose they thought that perhaps someone who'd been down the road might have some worthwhile observations to make. They are, of course, familiar with the text of the Scripture, and you are familiar. And my purpose tonight is just to remind you what you perhaps know already, and then to give you some few insights into things that need to be of concern to us as we think about rearing children in the nurture or the discipline and admonition or instruction of the Lord. Being parents, in the final analysis, that will please God and that will bless the children, it's really just a matter of being what you ought to be. Mother or father, prospective mother or father, your task really is to be what God destined or dreamed, planned that you should be. The greatest thing that you can bring to the life of another person is something exemplary in yourself. And so I say to young couples, when they marry and they are anticipating children, that you need to begin to grow as much as possible as Christians. You need to take within yourself as much as you can get within yourself of the spirit and nature of Jesus. I know that parents cannot become perfect before they start the child-rearing process. I'm thankful that that wasn't necessary, because not only was I far from it when I began the child-rearing days, but I'm still not there. And I'll be struggling for that as long as I live, I'm sure. But there is a quality in the heart and life of a parent that will be a blessing to a child, and that is the willingness, the desire, and the determination to grow from the very beginning. I'm willing to learn. I want to learn. I want to be a better person. I want to be a blessing to my children. It's my concern. It's something that sits deep within me. I want to achieve that. I don't think anything is going to be achieved in the rearing of children that does not begin with some serious planning, some deep commitments. It's not a matter of having achieved everything that you propose to achieve. It's a matter of having it deep inside of you and being willing to give a lot of energy, even the most important energy of life, to this significant task. Who can imagine a more important responsibility than guiding and nurturing a human being made in the image of God? Not only a human being who will touch many, many others in the course of that one lifetime, for good or for ill, but who at last will spend that vast eternity somewhere, one of two places. And there's so much significance involved in that I suppose if we did not have some encouragement from God, we would all just fold in despair and quit. But there's no need for that. The Lord has not laid upon us as parents responsibilities that are greater than we can bear, and certainly He has not left us or abandoned us to the task without His help, which is so significant. This passage, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but nurture or train them up in the chastening or discipline and admonition or instruction of the Lord, is a passage that is sitting right in the middle of a series of instructions given to people in a relationship. The first instruction is given to wives and husbands, and the second then to children and parents, and the third to servants and masters. And the instruction, the key verse that began this whole series, is in verse 21 of the fifth chapter, subjecting yourselves one to another in the fear of the Lord. That is, out of a reverence for Him, out of a sense of worshipful awe toward Him, out of a sense of gratitude toward Him, out of a sense of thanksgiving toward Him, we submit ourselves one to another, and He means by that, you live selflessly for the sake of another. Now that means, insofar as the parent is concerned, that this is not a task which means I'm the boss in this house. That's not the task. That's not the task of the husband who said, well, I'm the boss here, you know. The task of the leader in this case, which a parent certainly is, with awesome responsibilities, with challenges that sometimes will be so heavy that they'll drive you to your knees to seek help from God. Their task, the task of the parent, is to live for the child. I mean, for the ultimate well-being of the child. That is, to serve the child's needs. We're not suggesting for a single moment that parents are here so that they can do the bidding of their children. You mustn't misunderstand. Children are not supposed to be spoiled, selfish, demanding individuals who simply call upon their parents to bring what they want and let every need be supplied as the children perceive it. What the Lord, through the Apostle Paul here, meant by that was that you are supposed to sacrifice what you might like for yourself and what you might desire for yourself in order to serve the needs of the child, the ultimate needs of the child, not the momentary desires of the child, but the ultimate needs of the child. And who better than a Christian to understand what those ultimate needs are? To be sobered by the fact that we're not just working on something that is going to affect the job you're going to have in life, or that's going to affect where you're going to build your house or spend your days in this sphere. But ultimately, spiritually, essentially, life as it is in that transcendent sense, that's what we're working with here. But we've got to work with ourselves first. You can't have a dream for your child if you have no dream for yourself. If you've not brought yourself together and disciplined yourself to a certain end, in this particular case, I think none of us are under any illusions what that is. We are concerned to serve God. If we haven't disciplined ourselves to that end, there's no way in the world that we will make a contribution to our children in that direction. Others may do so. In fact, every earnest parent trying prayerfully every day to guide his or her children welcomes the help and support of others, desires the counsel, will seek out that counsel, often when perplexed by what to do next and distressed and deeply concerned, and sometimes even brokenhearted over the circumstance of the child, that individual will seek out very earnestly the help of others and be often in prayer to God, who is the great helper of us all, about this and other enterprises. You want to remember that this passage has implicit in it the idea of a purpose and a plan, a dream, an aim for the child. Why would you discipline or train a child for no purpose? If there is no direction to it, there is no basis upon which to govern what kind of discipline you're going to give. or what kind of instruction you're going to give. It is presumed here that there is a dream for the child. And I can tell you that he begins by cutting away all the trash, by saying to the father, and I suggest to you he's simply speaking to the father because the father has the primary responsibility of leadership in the home, not because the mother's not involved, but because the father needs to recognize that he is the leader here. And that when he abandons his responsibility by just sort of turning that over to the wife, that he really has failed. He has failed. And his children will at last look on that as a failure. They will remember the days when their mother took concern for them, and when she bore the burdens of their early training, and the father was busy about other things and had no time. That will not be forgotten. I don't mean that it'll be held against you in some sort of bitterness the rest of the days of the child, but I mean by that that the child will always feel the impress of that emptiness, that thing that was missed in early days. So avoid injustice and avoid harshness and severity that is not called for in your treatment of children. And let me tell you something else. Avoid indifference. I cannot think of anything that would more rouse the righteous indignation of a child at last than a parent that's just indifferent, who seems not to care. Avoid constant criticism that drives the child to give up, to simply dissolve in despair because the child has decided there is no way I will please my parent and there's no sense trying. These are to be avoided. I want to say to you, I believe that any parent who's a child of God and who brings to this task a sense of humility and a sense of the importance of it and love in his own life could not do that. Not for long. There may be mistakes made. There may be lapses. There certainly will be on all our parts. But this cannot continue. Injustice, harshness, severity, indifference to the child, constant criticism. That in no way can be a part of a program of positive training and discipline that's going to produce a whole individual that is a joy to God and a delight to everyone whose life is touched by that child. A purpose, an aim. There are some unworthy parental aims, and they are in the minds and hearts of parents who haven't even thought out their own lives. Or maybe they have thought out their own lives, and their own lives are filled with unworthy aims. Can you imagine parents who dream for their child that he will be a sports star? Can you imagine that? Is that short-sighted or not? Sports star? One of the greatest basketball players of our time is retired at age what? 32. 32 years old. 30 years old, out. And in some cases, these great sports heroes have bodies that are racked by injury after injury that has made them old men even when they're young. And not only that, if they have been wise enough to hold on to the money that's passed through their hands, and many of them have not been, all they have is money to do what with? To invest where? Energies and minds that have now outlived their usefulness because there's no more sports activity. I cannot imagine parents dreaming of glory, and I think sometimes for themselves, that they can run about the country and say, yes, that's my boy. I don't want you to think I'm saying that you should not delight in the success your child will have in sports activities. I would have especially delighted in it in view of the fact that I knew that I had given nothing to the child hereditarily. Poor child, ill-equipped genetically to have much of it. And I always thought, that's wonderful. Must get it from his mother or from her mother. It's not wrong to take delight in your child's success. But always you remember, always you know, that looking far beyond that, this is not what it is about. And you, my darling child, know, we know together that that's the case. Can you imagine someone dreaming for a child that that child would become some magnificent business tycoon with power and influence and money. Power and influence and money for what? To do what? To be what? To achieve what? To say that that's shallow, to say that it has absolutely no depth whatsoever, is to say the obvious. But it also says something about the parent. Any parent who dreams such dreams about his child and thinks that this is the aim, this is what it's about, and I must be sure that my child gets all the kind of early training and discipline to achieve that, what a waste. And they themselves are shallow people. You have to be careful. Sometimes those old dreams that you thought had been put to rest, that you thought now were nothing, and that you really had got your hands solidly on eternal values, sometimes they can come back, and you, they're stirred when the child shows some ability in that direction, and you get just really almost overwrought about that, and you praising the child and declaring the glories of this sort of thing, and other things, qualities of character, honor, righteousness, goodness, they sort of slip past, and we have no words to speak about them. I know I have said to you many times, maybe ad nauseum, that when you praise something inordinately in a child, the child will get the message that that's what life is all about and that's what you're expecting him to be. You cannot praise goodness in a child inordinately because there is no way to praise it too high. You cannot praise honesty and purity and holiness in a child at too high a level because there's no way to elevate it beyond its importance. Praise those things. And when a child has a spiritual victory, you make that sound like they have won the World Series. Because that's exactly how important it is. Bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. How do we do that? First of all, by the simple task of saying in my heart and mind, this child is given to God. Insofar as I am able to effect it. We understand that not all the influences are in our hands. We're dealing with a child who has a free will like ourselves. But I often think of Hannah, and I can't think of a better illustration. In the first chapter of 1 Samuel, who comes with her earnest petitions to God. She wants a child, a son. She wants a son. But the noble part about it is, she said, if you will give me a son, I will give him to you. Now, of course, she meant a bit more than we might today. She intended, as she did, to bring him to the high priest at Shiloh and give him into the hands of Eli and let him be a servant to Eli to serve the purposes of God in the house of the high priest. And at last he became far more perhaps than she ever imagined because she turned him over to God. And then God, having taken over, made him a prophet. An immoral and spiritual power in the nation. He was the heartbeat of Israel in his day. Because he was a man of such integrity and of such spirituality. But we need to do that with our children. We need to get on our knees and say, I want this little girl to be yours. I want this little boy to be yours. You have given him, you have given her to us. Help us to give them back to you. That is the ultimate aim, even though we're not at this point dealing with the particulars. Let's look first of all at this matter of discipline. The first word used here, it's a Greek word which suggests the training of a child. The word child is in it. As I said before, there is no discipline that is more significant than just the example we set, and not just some conscious sort of thing. You can't do this consciously, although you can consciously attempt to be what you need to be by making the effort to stay very close to the Lord and to be very close to His Word and to wrestle personally with the flaws in your own life and to let your children know. Well, you don't need to let them know. They'll find that out. You just do it, and they'll find it out. They will learn about their father and their mother that my father and my mother are not perfect, but they really want to do right. And I see in them a concern for eternal things. I see those are the things that move them. And those are the sort of things that disturb them. Those are the sort of things that occupy their conversation. They don't talk about the stock market all the time. They don't talk about what's happening in the American and the National League all the time. They don't talk about what's happening in downtown Louisville all the time. They don't talk about the weather all the time. They talk about, and you can tell by the way they react to it, you can tell that this is important to my mother and father. You think children, they pick that up. There's no way you can keep them from picking it up. Example. You want godly children, be godly. You want children that love the Lord, love the Lord. You want children that are unselfish, be unselfish. You want children that show compassion to others, show compassion to others. You want children that are obedient, then be obedient to God yourself. You want children that have learned how to discipline themselves, then be sure you have disciplined yourself. There's no way that a parent out of control can bring a child under control. Not possible. But this idea of discipline suggests control. And I want to say to you, there's not a thing in the world wrong with controlling a child. You must control the child. The child cannot control himself. He has come into the world without any sense of self-control. That must be taught and trained into the child. And if we are to do that, it means that there are positive things that we need to do. We need to train the child to have a sense of the greatness of God. We try to do that in our Bible classes here, but you need to do that in your home at the dinner table or when you walk by the way. You need to train into that child a sense of the greatness of God. And of course, it's, as we said, something they experience in your example when they see you responding to God with a great sense of respect. Then they also will be led in that direction. You have no idea. I think some of us as parents have no idea at all how much influence we have on our children. You'll learn that later, sometimes to your great delight and sometimes to your great dismay. You have all the advantages. I don't care about television. Shut the thing down. And even public schools, no matter how much a horror sometimes they are, you're the one who brought that child into the world whose face they first saw, whose emotions and feelings have come into them like a running stream from the very beginning because you are the parent. And even on that day when some adolescent child seems to be in utter rebellion against you, they are in rebellion against themselves because when they look in your face, they're looking at themselves. So, control is important. Train them to give thanks and to be grateful. Train them to appreciate what is right. Even when they're young and cannot fully morally grasp this thing, you talk about what's right and doing what's right. And you talk with them about telling the truth. A lot of little children have special trouble with the truth. Well, they're learning. And sometimes some of them will just tell some awful whoppers. And they'll just dismay you with the kind of things they'll say sometimes. And you say, this is a sociopath I'm bringing up here. It has no sense of conscience whatsoever. Well, that's not so. They just need training. They need control. They need discipline. And the day will have to come when you'll have to say, if you do that, here's the consequence of it. Well, you did that. Now the consequence is coming. Rewards and punishments. Perfectly legitimate way of doing things. When they are consistent with the great principles of God, you don't want to reward something that is something you ought to do anyway. You ought not to make something punishment, which is something a person ought to want to do, which is a happy part of life. Now, there are some wise choices to be made here. And I think the time comes when if the corporal punishment is not working, use something else. Don't go on endlessly with that and pump on some dry hole that's not achieving your purpose with the child. But the child has got to know now that there are consequences for misbehavior and there are rewards for acting right. If we don't teach them that, then we're not teaching them reality. Because that's reality. That's divine reality. There's a hell out there for people that don't want to do right. And there's a heaven for those that want to. And God has made it that way. And it's that way because God is the way He is. He can't live with ungodly, selfish people. He cannot do that. and we can't live with Him. And that's what hell is in the final analysis. It's being cut off from God in the darkness. And He can live and wants to live with all those that have a true heart and a penitent disposition and a sincere mind. It's not just the good people. There are not any of us that are good. But the people that want to be good and that are determined in their brokenhearted, humble way to do the will of God. Those kind of people will live with the Lord. There are consequences to behavior. We have to teach our children that. There's no way to escape that. Oh, you can protect them from it for a while, but you're not going to live long enough to protect them from it throughout a lifetime. And you absolutely are not going to live long enough to protect them from it when we have passed beyond the pale of this sphere. You understand what I mean when I say we must subject ourselves to the needs of our children? That we must forget what we might like to do at this particular point in our lives? How we might like to spend this time, spend these hours. We have chosen to be parents, and therefore, consequently, we have chosen and we have accepted the responsibility of guiding these children, and they are going to demand time. I've said to these young parents that you need to get your own relationship good, as solid as you can, before you bring this other party in. Because they're going to put you to the test. They're going to put your relationship to the test. All those hours of crying, and you don't know what's wrong. And they can't tell you what's wrong. And you try everything you know to do, and it doesn't help. And you say, when are we going to get any sleep around here? And the answer is, not for a while. You need to have a sense of the relationship the two of you have so that you can work through that time. That's important. And it's important to have a sense of who you are and what you're trying to do here. Because you're going to be tested in your desire and your determination to give this child to God. It's easier in the dream than it is in the reality. And so sooner or later, we've got to put our feet on the floor and achieve what needs to be achieved. Going to worship? Yes. Child needs to be trained to go and sit with other people in an assembly where God is worshipped and revered. We've had so many people say, I'm not going to make my child do that. Well, why not forevermore? You make the child do everything else. Less consequential. Train him in sanitary habits. Try to teach him how to behave at the table so he doesn't embarrass everybody. Some rudimentary manners in dealing with other people. Of all things, absolutely. There has been never a day that a young child who has been told, we're all going to church today, sonny. You're in this family. We're glad to have you in this family. That's what this family does. Get in the car. We're on our way. It's time to go to school, we say. You're not staying home today. Oh, well, I have a tummy ache. I know what you got. No tummy ache. We've been through this before. It's time to go to school. And we can get rather adamant about that. Why do we think that children are not going to grow up hating education on account of that? And yet we will say foolishly that if we make this child go and experience these spiritual things and get involved in spiritual education, they're going to grow up hating God. Preposterous. They're going to hate God only if you're a hypocrite. And they know the truth about what you're doing. So, discipline, control, correction. No filthy talk in this house. Prayer at night, when we're together, reading the scripture together, worshiping together. Yes, all those things must be a part of the plan. Honesty, truthfulness, and no filth and foul TV or videos. I've never seen a group of parents throw up their hands and quit over something like that. They just sort of say, well, they're going to see it anyway. Well, if they do, it ought to be over your objections and arrangements. Gary Ogden, who some of you have heard preach, has a rule at his house, there will be no radio or television. Watch, this will really get you into trouble with a group of teenagers. No radio or television except in the family room. I want to go to my room and listen to my radio and just, that's what I want to do. I know. But the truth of the matter is that young people that age, and it's not because they are venal and mean and wicked, they are not to be trusted. I'm not saying this is the answer always, but I'm saying that we need to recognize that sometimes we have to make or put constraints on young people because they're not ready yet to discipline themselves. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not going to be allowed to make their mistakes, and I'll say a word about that just before we close, and that's going to be pretty quick. But we've got to exercise these corrections, and we need not apologize for it. I think some of us are almost terrified out of our minds by our children. Sewell Hall told about a meeting of parents of senior students in a school. And these are not Christians. But they were asked the question, how many of you are afraid of your children? Almost every parent raised his hand. Afraid. Mystified. Intimidated. We don't know what to do. Do you know what's right? Do you know what God's will is? If the aim is to cause this child to follow Jesus Christ and to be what God destined this eternal spirit to be, then you know what you need to stand for. And you know what you need to inculcate and teach. And you know what you need to oppose. And patiently to instruct. But when your instruction does not satisfy, then to say, we're not going to do this. And there are penalties and consequences for doing otherwise. That's because I love you and because this is what I want for you. But that, of course, is not enough. There has to be the positive instruction. The instruction of the Lord. We've got to move this process. And that's what those critical years are about. We've got to move this process from children who want to be or who are moved to be like mother and father are to children who want to be like Jesus. Now, that's the process. A change takes place. Here we are. We're down here at the very beginning. And very little is left to the child in terms of freedom to choose. Much control at the beginning. Very narrow sliver of activity. We let the child choose. Maybe what flavor ice cream you're going to have this time. Or if we decide they're going to have ice cream. Otherwise, they'll eat ice cream every meal. Is that good? Or maybe they just won't eat at all because they're busy. Is that good? We don't allow that. We know that they're not capable of making those decisions. They're children. They're infants sometimes. And so, but as time passes, as they get out here 6, 9, 12, and 16, we have widened the area where they are allowed to exercise their judgment and decisions. Because we have to do that because ultimately they're going to do it anyway. They'll be out of our homes. And we have this time, to instruct them in the ways of the Lord. We must exchange the control of parents for the control of God. Now, what's happening here is that as this widening influence takes place, so far as our control is concerned, that something else is happening in the life of the child, so far as the influence of the principles we have taught them are concerned. Out here, beyond what we can enforce, in a realm where we cannot enforce anything anymore, there comes home the great principles that we have lovingly taught them, that have now become a part of their thinking. Not because we think this way, but because they themselves think this way. If these things are true, if these things are right, then deep within inside the psyche of the child is a sense of what is honorable, is a sense of what is true, is a sense of what is eternal, is a sense of what is important here in this life. And these things I must live by because this is who I am. This is not a robot out here. This is a child who's choosing. But choosing with the parameters of what that child has learned from earliest infancy about what is ultimately real and true. The day is going to come when that child will leave your household and do whatever he or she good and well pleases, and many of these things you will not know about at all. The task is to prepare them for that hour so that when they leave this house, they will leave with God in their hearts. The rewards and punishments of parents must be replaced by the rewards and punishments of God. So we give them to the Lord. It's an awesome task, and if God weren't helping us, we'd all need to give up, but He's in the picture. The power of His Word is here. The truth about the nature of children that He has Himself made is here. the absolute perfect harmony between His teachings and ways and the way we are created. That's here. And His providence in guiding the course of our lives in love. That's here too. But you've got to love your children. And you've got to pay attention. And we're going to try, as grandfather types and grandmother types, not to poke our nose in your business. And we're certainly going to try not to be standing around looking down our noses while you are struggling in absolute frustration to do your job. And we're just standing over there, you know, without any responsibility now saying, well, look at these young parents. They don't ever get anything right. Let these kids run around like a bunch of wild people. We're going to try not to do that. But that's not helpful, is it? But if we can talk, if we can encourage, if we can see you doing a good job and say to you, you're doing good, you're right on target, this is what you need to do, don't be discouraged, we're going to do that. And only in critical areas, maybe, when we see tough things happening, will we come to you and say, and this we will use out of our little credit account that only has so much in it. We'll say, could we talk? I got a concern for you. I know you want to be a good parent, but there's something I want to talk to you about. And I hope you'll accept that in the loving way it's intended. We're on your side. God is on the side of parents that are trying to do right. Now, this final thought, how parents can help the efforts made by this local church to be effective. They're not automatically effective. Just because you get your children these Bible classes, they're not automatically effective. Obviously, the major responsibility for the training and admonition of the child is yours. You have the greatest influence. There's no way you can turn it over to someone else. You can abandon it, but you cannot turn it over to someone else. No one else can do that. But the church can help. Have your children present and on time. This is a list made by a group of Bible class teachers in a congregation in Georgia. Have your children present and on time at the class. That means you'd have to be on time, of course, unless they're going to go ahead of you. You have to be on time. Second, study the lesson with your children. Well, you say, I don't have time for that. You've got to have time for that. You've been studying math with them? And even when you didn't even understand half of it, you had to study. You had to do something here. And you've been studying the history lesson with them, and you've been studying the geography lesson with them, and you've been studying all the lessons with them. What does it say if we don't study this lesson with them? What does that say? Number three, help them with their memory work. Somebody said, well, the teacher gave them that. That's their job. Is that the attitude you take about everything else? What about the spelling work? Do you do anything at all to be sure they got those spelling words down? Come here. Have you got these spelling words down? Yeah. Oh, come here. Let's see if you got them down. I'm going to give them to you. We'll see if you can spell them. Oh, I don't need to do that. Yes, you do. You need to do that. Review the lesson after the class. What did you learn today? Let's talk about it. And number five, reinforce and apply the lessons at home with such questions as, what would Jesus do about that situation? What do you think is right in this case? Talk to the child. This is nurture. That word, nurture, is the same word that's translated nourish in Ephesians 5:29. No man hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it. Cherish that child. Nourish that child. Feed that child. Give the child what is needed. And this is what instruction is. This, you are a teacher. And number six, inquire about the class your child attends. And come to know the teacher. And enter into a partnership with that teacher. Because you are the primary teacher. And here is someone who's there to help. Oh, this is an abridged lesson. We just stop in the middle. And sometime in the future I'll pick up on some of this. But God is... He's in your corner. And really, in the final analysis, all you have to do to be a good parent is to love God with all your heart and to love those children. And everything sort of takes its proper place after that. But we don't love God. And by the way, I think loving God calls you to love other people and love your children especially someone that's as natural to love as your children are. Surely we can, if we love God, we would love our children. Then everything that we do out of love for them, selfless love for them, in order to achieve this ultimate end, even when they don't appreciate it, even when they don't understand it, even when they cry out against it, we lovingly, patiently persist in guiding them in the right ways of the Almighty. What a wonderful privilege, what an awesome task. We've got some wonderful parents in this church. I've had occasion just to watch them, and they're trying to develop within their children something wonderful and grand, and I want to encourage you. You keep on growing as the child of God so that you can make your children the child of God, the children of God. You keep on enlarging yourself and being willing to accept correction from the Lord and instruction from Him so that you can be a good instructor of those who are in your charge. May the Lord bless us to that end. If you're not a Christian tonight, the Lord would like to have you as His child to nourish and to cherish and to guide and to keep in the most unselfish love that could be imagined. Not anything in it for Himself, but everything in it for you. You never had a father like this. You may have had a very inadequate father. And perhaps memories of that mother or that father may be very hard in your heart. But I'm going to tell you something. This Father will never disappoint you. He will love you and cherish you and guide you and direct you and discipline you and instruct you in a way that will be a blessing. Never for Himself will He do it. Always for you. Such a Father He is. And if you're going to be His child, then you must come and submit yourself to Him as He has taught, by coming to say to His Son that He sent into the world to die for you, "You are the Lord. You are the Lord. I accept You as the Christ. I yield to Your will." And then to be baptized as that same Lord has directed, buried in the water, raised up again, but by the grace of God and the blood of Jesus Christ, every sin cleansed, a new relationship begun, a new life given to you, and all under the direction of the kind, loving guidance and nurture of the Father of lights, in whom there is never any variation, never any inconsistency, never any indifference, never any harshness, never any injustice. Won't you come to Christ tonight for all the standing and singing?